Welcome to The Safety Break, the Whitewater Rescue Podcast. We're here to share stories of real river accidents and rescues and find expert advice on how to solve the problems you might encounter in the Whitewater River environment. I'm your host, Jack Diddy, an emergency medicine physician, whitewater paddler, and wilderness medicine educator. Together, I hope we can celebrate successful rescues and learn from our mistakes in a supportive environment. If you have a story to share of a non-fatal accident or rescue, send me an email at thesafetybreak@gmail.com or contact me on our Facebook page, The Safety Break. If you like what you hear, hit the subscribe button and follow us on social media. I hope you learned something valuable in the show.
Offline, there was no, correcting it. I was already moving towards a drop. There was no eddies or anything like that to catch. So I was just like, well, I'm going to have to drive at it and hope for the best. So I just drove at the lip, and right at the edge of the drop, it got really shallow, about 3 inches deep. And I dried out, basically lost all my speed, couldn't get a good boost stroke, and just pitched over the edge of that rock. I was able to, not over-rotate and land on my head. I did get a stroke in, and I tucked, plugged, came up upside down, rolled. And when I rolled, I saw a rock wall right in front of me, and I knew that I was under the curtain, and it was a bad situation. After, a few minutes, after I got trapped back there, and making a few unsuccessful attempts to get through the curtain. That was when the gravity of the situation really started to hit me, that I'm probably not going to be able to get out here on my own, and I don't know how in the world anyone's going to be able to get in here to get to me.
In December of 2022, Curtis May had the misfortune of becoming trapped behind the curtain of a large waterfall on the Agua Azul in Chiapas, Mexico. From his vantage point, there was no obvious means of escape. There was a vertical rock wall to the left, a thick curtain of water in front of him, and a large undercut wall on his right, extending as far as he could see around the corner. He made multiple attempts to drive through the curtain to escape, but was rejected each time by the huge force of the current. As his energy waned, he eventually became resigned to the idea that he would just have to wait for a rescue, paddle across this undercut wall into the unknown, or potentially die in this watery trap. Meanwhile, his friends were trying to pierce through the curtain from the downstream side, but meeting similar obstacles. Fortunately, all this was captured on video, posted on YouTube. There's a link to it from our Facebook page, or you can just search for Live Bait Rescue Agua Azul. I'd encourage our listeners to view it either before or after listening to this episode. After I saw the video of this rescue, I wanted to hear firsthand about the decisions made that day and the process of the rescue. Similar to our last episode, a tethered swimmer rescue, also known as live bait, was used to reach the victim. Before we hear the actual rescue story, let's talk about this technique for a few minutes. It's often the best option for retrieving an unconscious or entrapped paddler, or any time a rescuer has to enter the water with high downstream hazards. It's worth having a basic understanding of it if you're spending a lot of time in complex whitewater environments. I've linked several instructional videos about it on the Safety Break Facebook site if you want more information. I also spoke with Zach Brown, a swiftwater rescue instructor and co-owner of Water Training Resources, a training center in the Northeast that focuses on water rescue training for professional rescuers. Here's his description of live bait rescues.
So a tethered swimmer or live bait, to me, it's one of the best go-to rescue techniques out there. And the reason I say that is that it's equipment-wise, it requires minimal equipment. In theory, all you need is a throw bag, and you can just tie in to a rescue ring as long as they have a Type 5 PFD. And they're very successful. So with a live bait rescue, there are several ways you can teach it. But in theory, you have two people on shore at minimum. One person will be tied off to their rescue ring on their Type 5 PFD. And that's an important part to touch upon, is that when you're tying someone off in a river, they need to be able to release that. So you don't want a hard tie into someone around their waist or on their chest. You want to make sure they have a releasable ring for that. And the reason being is that if they get in a jam, at least they can pop free and then swim out into an eddy and get free of that situation. So on shore, you know, one of the rescuers will tie into the other person's ring. If you're using a carabiner, you want to make sure that it's a locking carabiner. I'm sure you've read plenty of stories of non-locking carabiners getting snagged or stuck on stuff in the river. Essentially, what's happening is that as they jump into the river, they have that throw bag is on shore with that other rescuer. And so now they can swim out to the victim wherever they may be. And if they're unsuccessful at swimming out there and it's in a, you know, high hazard environment or there's consequence if they get washed downstream, now they can just be pendulum back to shore and try it again. Also, if they go out and get a victim that's maybe unresponsive, now they get hands on the victim and now they can be pulled back to shore as well. So it's one of those things where they can enter an environment and if they get in a jam, they can be pulled out of that environment as well. And that's why I think it's so effective and efficient.
It's important for the rescue swimmer and the belayer to scout the situation together. Planning the entry point, looking for possible rope snags or obstacles in the pendulum swing path of the rope, and anticipating the safe place to land the rescuer and the victim back to shore. Don't plan to lower into something such as a sieve or a strainer and expect to be pulled back upstream against the flow, as the force of water on the swimmer is usually too much for this.
It's one of those things where taking an extra 30 seconds ahead of time can save you 3 or 4 minutes down the road. And the reason I say that is scout out your area. So if you have an area that maybe it's 80 feet downstream and you only have a 50-foot throw bag, we can tie two throw bags together and now you have a 100-foot throw bag and now you can get them to that 80-foot takeout mark.
The rescuers should also take a moment to discuss communication, maybe agreeing on some simple hand signals about giving or taking slack with the rope, or to abort and reel in the attempt.
So the root of all issues when things happen or things go wrong is communication. So I think taking that second and saying, hey, this is our game plan, and having someone take charge, say it's three people who don't know each other, as long as someone takes charge and explains, hey, this is our plan, this is what we're doing, you know, you're the rescuer, you're the belayer, and explains it out, it's going to be fine. Now, with that said, the more you train together, obviously the more efficient you're going to be, and now you can operate essentially without even talking, which is a huge plus because you're more efficient.
The rescue swimmer needs to be comfortable and confident in the water. They need to be able to swim aggressively and time the swim appropriately while paying attention to obstacles that might snag the rope. Once reaching the victim, they need to grab the shore side of the victim's PFD and keep their head up, usually dragging them backwards through the water.
I think the biggest limitation with a live bait rescue is going to be your rescuer. Not all people are created equal. Some people are better swimmers than others. Some people can read a river better. And so maybe they're not a strong swimmer, but maybe they can read the river better and they can get to that place a little more efficiently. I think it's important to put your best person out there. When it comes to this, it's a time to put egos aside and put your best foot forward and say, who's our best swimmer? Who can go do this? Because not only will it keep them safer and the rest of the team safe, but also they don't want to become part of the problem. So put your ego aside, let the best swimmer go.
For the belayer, the most important thing is to have a very strong stance and anchor position, anticipating the large force of the swimmer and victim on the rope.
So the person on shore is essentially belaying them. So you'll have the rope on the downstream side of you. So if something were to happen and you have to let go of the rope, you can let go and it's not going to be wrapped around you. But that's their primary job, is to maintain positive contact via the rope with that rescue swimmer so that either you can pull them out of the hazard, pull them and the victim out, or get them back to shore if they wash out. It's important to know that as that shore-based rescuer, that you have good footing, and it's almost better if you can sit down and jam your feet in some rocks, because what people quickly don't realize is the force of water on someone as they start, and now at a victim to that, that's a lot of force on that rescuer. So that's why it's really important to have some, you know, good footing, preferably sitting down in a good stance. And if you have a second person, hey, hold on to the back of my PFDs. As essentially, it's a meat anchor when you think about it.
let's get on with this rescue and hear the story from the beautiful travertine landscape of the Agua Azul in southeastern Mexico. Here's our guests.
I'm Curtis May. I live in the southeast. Typically, I'm Texas right now, but normally I'm in Virginia, in Roanoke. I've been paddling since I was like 4 years old. My dad got me into it, and I really started doing kayaking when I was around 19.
My name is Wesley Schellmeyer. Been paddling since I was 10 years old. Started canoeing originally. Got into whitewater kayaking shortly after. And my current occupation, I work at Cry School, just south of Asheville, and I'm a kayaking instructor, ACA level 4 kayaking instructor, and swiftwater rescue technician.
I'd never been down there. In fact, I'd never been paddling outside of like the East Coast of the United States. One of my buddies, Jacob Simpson, you know, said he was putting a trip together and asked if I wanted to go down there. And I was like, absolutely.
Jacob, Curtis, Shane Simino, and then Isaac Martinez, who's from Mexico. And that was the crew. Oh, and then, of course, Chiri, a younger kid also from Mexico. So our plan was to drive to the Oro and then from there continue driving south to the Salto de Agua, and then even farther south, southeast to the Agua Azul, which is in Chiapas, the farthest southeast state. It borders Guatemala.
They wanted to get down to the Agua Azul. That was kind of like the highlight of the whole trip, I guess, because it doesn't get run that often. It's really remote. It's like an extra 5 hour drive south from any other spot that typically gets paddled.
Geology is very interesting. This is sandstone that's not quite stone. Very, very crumbly. I mean, it's like if you took a beach and like packed it down a little harder, you'd, you know, this is the type of rock you would get. But it creates these amazing waterfalls. And then Salto de Agua is a little harder rock, and there's more flow at that point and becomes kind of some big water. It's one of the prettiest rivers you'll ever see. I mean, baby blue Caribbean water and just waterfalls everywhere. It's not super high volume. I'm sure when it rains a lot, it's pretty high volume. It's not high volume, but there's a lot of waterfalls and it kind of fans out. And in certain areas, there might be, you know, 5 or 6 different channels where the water's flowing and waterfalls on each channel. So it creates this gorgeous scenery. And I've really never experienced any other place like it. There's kind of 2 different sections in that area. There's this short waterfall section in the town of Agua Azul. And it kind of, the town is just right next to all these waterfalls. And we walked our boats up and ran a short little section down to the town. And we did that the day we got there, or the day after we got there, kind of as a warm up. The actual section with where the accident occurred is much more committing. It's more of an all day kind of ordeal. It's called the Seven Kings is the section where there's 7 pretty fairly large waterfalls, kind of culminating in the final 3, which are the most filmed. And it's a 30-foot waterfall into a 65-foot waterfall, followed by the final 40-foot waterfall. But there's really not in between the 30-footer and the 60-footer, it's very difficult access. So it's very committing. Once you go over the first waterfall, you're pretty much committed to the 65-foot waterfall.
Yeah, so we're all feeling really good. We put on and we're making our way through, you know, like I said, those different channels and stuff. There were a bunch of, at the beginning, there were a bunch of like 10 to 15 foot drops. And it was just really fun. Beautiful. So beautiful.
So there was a few jangly moments, but in general, everyone was having good lines. We hadn't had any incidents. So we were all pretty confident going into it. We got to the crux area. And we got out of our boats to go scout these 3 drops. And we came up with a safety plan. We talked that over probably for about 20 minutes. And so the plan was we would have two safety boaters below the 65-foot drop. We would have one spotter who was going to communicate with the safety boaters and whoever was on top. And we would have one person flying the drone and filming.
And the lead-in to the first of the three, the one where the incident occurred, the lead-in is tricky because there's a whole bunch of little wave holes like just peppered all the way across the entrance to it. And there's one kind of like little shallow low angle slide, and you got to identify where the outflow from this one thing is going and be at a certain point relative to it to be where you want to be. But and the trail runs along the right side of the river. It's about 15 feet above the level of the first drop, right? But it's really dense forest. There's only a few spots along that trail where you can see the first drop. So you can be downstream of it and see it. Then you can be like right on line with it and kind of see it. And then you can be, there's like maybe two spots upstream of it where you get a gap through the trees and you can see it. I saw like the lip of the drop from downstream. I'm like, okay, this is where I want to go. I can kind of see like this flow's coming here, this little wave's there. And then I walk upstream and I had to try to identify those spots again. And at some point in there, I misidentified one of the little waves or holes. And I'm like, okay, I need to hit this one and then I'll be lined up. And I thought I'd gotten far enough left, but I hadn't. When I realized I was offline, there was no, correcting it. I was already moving towards a drop. There was no eddies or anything like that to catch. So I was just like, well, I'm going to have to drive at it and hope for the best. So I just drove at the lip, and right at the edge of the drop, it got really shallow, about 3 inches deep. And I dried out, basically lost all my speed, couldn't get a good boost stroke, and just pitched over the edge of that rock. And I was able to, not over-rotate and land on my head. I did get a stroke in, and I tucked, and I plugged, came up upside down, rolled. And when I rolled, I saw a rock wall right in front of me, and I knew that I was under the curtain, and it was a bad situation.
And I was setting safety below the 65-footer. And I kind of knew what time Curtis was supposed to go. It was going to be, 3 or 4 minutes. So I'm at the bottom waiting, and it gets to 3 minutes, nothing. Gets to 4 minutes, nothing. Gets to 5 minutes. I'm like, what's going on? I look up, and Jacob is standing. He's the spotter at the time. And he kind of puts his arms up, like, I don't know where he is. And then he gives me kind of this waterfall sign with his hand and points behind it. And immediately I was like, this is not good. It's kind of like our worst fear, you have somebody stuck behind a waterfall. So at that point I told Cheery to stay, just stay here in case anything comes over this waterfall. If it's a body, if it's him, if it's gear, just watch for stuff coming off the waterfall. I quickly paddled to the shore and pretty much climbed almost 90 degrees, up trees with my boat, which was exhausting, but I was just going as quickly as I could. Ran up to the top. And when I arrived at the top, I saw that Isaac had already run the first drop and he was in Shane's boat and he was trying to paddle up into the curtain. And I kind of talked to Shane and Jacob about what happened. And they said he was behind the waterfall. They hadn't seen him.
So I had a big room that I was in, and where I was sitting, I had a little rock to hold on to. I sat there for probably a minute or so, just kind of gathering myself, looking around, literally just looking around under there to see if there was, any obvious opportunity to get out. And I blew my whistle first off, like right away, just so they would know, in hopes that they would hear me and know that I was, you know, at least still alive back there. They could never hear my whistle. I couldn't hear theirs. I couldn't see them. They couldn't see me. We didn't establish any type of communication at all. It was very fortunate that I was pushed into the little spot where I was pushed, because it was the only spot under there that wasn't really undercut, that was relatively calm, and I had that little pocket where I could just kind of sit and hold on to that rock there. You know, it was just like a little eddy right there, but you still had to edge, you know, that left side up to keep the current from, you know, grabbing your edge and wanting to flip you over. And tell you what, after an hour and 10 minutes of engaging your left hip, my goodness, my hip flexors on my left side were just on fire. So about every 5 minutes or so I was under there, I'd make an attempt to paddle through the curtain. And the first few times I tried, I paddled straight ahead, right in front of me, because I figured that was the safest bet. If I failed, I could just come right back to the little point of safety I had there. But there was just a boil line right in front of me that was between 12 and 18 inches high, and it was just impossible to paddle over. There was a spot slightly to the right where the curtain was offset, so I would try to shoot through that gap. You could tell that the boil there was only about 8 inches tall, and there was like you could like maybe just shoot through there. And I tried going through there probably half a dozen times. The curtain was like crashing down on me, right? On my skirt, on my head, on my paddle. So I'm like 18 inches away from getting pushed the other way out of it, right? But I just can't get there, because as soon as it starts coming down on you, you know, the curtain's falling from 35 feet up. It just pushes you down. It pushes your paddle down. You can't get in effective strokes in. So you lose all your momentum. And I'm sitting there trying to paddle through this thing, and I just can't do it. It was so frustrating.
So my thought was, Isaac needs help. We need two people down there for this rescue. So I went up to the top, ran the first drop again, ran the 30 footer. And there was on river left, there was this kind of shelf that we could stand on. So anyway, we got out on the shelf and we started trying to throw ropes behind the curtain, which pretty quickly we realized was not going to work. The area where he had gone in was too far to even get a rope to, and there was no shallow water behind that one point. So we started trying to throw a rope behind the curtain kind of over near where we were, and that wasn't working either. Anytime the bag would hit the flow, it was just, there's too much water coming over. The bag would go straight down. The only thing I could think of is we need to get behind the curtain. So I had Isaac put me on live bait, and I started trying to get behind the curtain. Didn't work at all. I mean, I tried to push my hand, you know, into the curtain, and I couldn't get it 2 inches in. It would push my hand down.
After, you know, a few minutes, like after I got trapped back there and making a few unsuccessful attempts to get through the curtain, you know, that was when the gravity of the situation really started to hit me, that I'm probably not going to be able to get out here on my own. And I don't know how in the world anyone's going to be able to get in here to get to me. And I was like, man, this might be it. I thought, you know, the odds were low that I was going to survive. And that was after about 10 minutes. So it was an hour sitting back there, you know, still trying to get out, but realizing that I probably wasn't going to be successful. And that was rough. But, you know, you can't have a breakdown back there. It's not going to help your situation at all. So those were very short-lived moments.
And I could see Isaac was kind of starting to lose hope at this point, because we're almost an hour in. And me and Isaac agreed that if we were still down there within 25 minutes, we had to leave, because otherwise that would put everyone in the group at risk if we were out there at dark. And in my mind, I was like, we need to just step back for a second and look at everything and talk about what our options are, think about our time horizon. Because another factor was daylight. We started early that morning, but all the time it took to set safety and do this rotation, it was already getting pretty late. I mean, it was getting past 4 o'clock, and we knew what time the sun was going to set, and we knew it took about an hour to paddle out from where we were. We were both thinking, like, if we were back there, you know, we would want someone stopping at nothing to try to get us out. And I was like, if there's even a chance that he's still alive, like, we need to, we're the only ones in here. I mean, we can't call for help when you're in that situation where you're going to call, you're in Chiapas, like, you might be able to get a helicopter. Like, what are they going to do? You know? And that, the thought of having to leave and kayak out of there without one of our guys, without Curtis, was like pretty awful.
The only way I'm, going to get out of here is I'm going to have to paddle out here by myself, or if they get in here with me. And I couldn't see any way for them to get in here with me. I couldn't remember from having scouted it. I couldn't remember what the river right side, like near the bank, looked like. Like if there were gaps or openings or whatever. The current looked pretty strong going back towards the rock wall. And the rock wall was very obviously undercut and much closer to the curtain. Right? So you have less room for error. That rock overhang cave looked menacing, and you couldn't see what was beyond it. If I get pushed into that undercut wall, I'm probably done, right? Because I'm not going to be able to, might not be able to roll up against it, and if I come out of my boat, I'm under an undercut rock, on an undercut wall, and I'm probably done. So I was going to absolutely save that as a last resort. If it starts getting dark, then I know that they're going to have to leave. And I'm not going to be able to survive under here overnight. So, that was going to be my last option. And I had my watch on me. I knew what time it was. I could see the sky. I could see that it was starting to get a little dark. I didn't want to do anything that would have, that had a significant probability of making the situation any worse until that was the last option. So I was going to give, the rescuers every opportunity to get to me or launch some type of attempt before I did anything that could make it worse.
I got back in my boat. I started ferrying across, just looking for anything. I was like, if there's any way that we can get behind this curtain, like I'm gonna go back in there and try to see if we can find Curtis. So on the ferry back across, I saw this one area on the far river right side of the waterfall that was, there was much less water going over it. And it looked like there was a kind of a dark cave with a calm eddy behind it. You could see through the curtain. But I paddled into the cave, saw that there was, inside of this cave, there was an extra little hole and cave that kind of went back into a corridor. So I got out of my boat, shoved it into the rocks, crawled up into this corridor, into this other room, and saw that I was behind the curtain. On one side of the cave, I could see the curtain. And then if I poked my head out towards the curtain, I could see this corridor all the way back. And still, I knew that we didn't have that much time. We had probably about 10 minutes. And then I saw a little orange dot all the way down as far as I could see, and realized that it was Curtis's helmet. So immediately got really, really excited, went back to Isaac, said, hey, I think I saw his helmet. And Isaac looked at me and said, let's get him. So I said, all right. He hooked me up on live bait, And before I started, I said, if I go underwater for 3 seconds, then pull me in. Or if you hear a whistle, pull me in. I jump in the water, and it's surprisingly calmer than I thought it was going to be. The wall was undercut in some areas, but it felt pretty controllable. I had both feet on the wall, and I could kind of climb with my hands. So I just started kind of traversing this wall and got to this one area where the rock kind of came out a little bit, and it was obvious that it was undercut, more undercut. There was more water flowing backwards from the veil into this rock and going under. And it was also obvious that on the other side of that was kind of a deeper cave. And I knew that Curtis was behind this undercut. I tried to go around at one point and kind of started, my feet started getting sucked downwards into this undercut rock. And so I kind of pushed back and I tried one more time and still yelling the whole time, just hoping. As I really didn't want to try to go around, I knew how risky it was at that point. Like, that spot was very risky. So I thought I would wait a few more minutes yelling and just see if maybe Curtis paddled around the corner, or I could see him paddle up a little bit or get some sign, some sort of yell or anything.
It was about an hour, a little over an hour in, when I first heard a voice. And that moment gave me a lot of hope, because I mean, there had been zero contact, visual or audible, with anyone. I heard him and I was like, oh my goodness, okay, progress is being made. You know, there's communication established. And I was trying to figure out where he was. I thought he was through the curtain, and no idea he was under there with me.
I saw Curtis's boat, Curtis trying to make an attempt at the veil. And I think that's the first time that I really saw him and saw that he was in his boat. And I think that's the first time that he had made contact with us too.
And then I was like, man, I got to try that gap in the curtain again. And when I paddled out around, you know, I could see around the corner of the rock, that's where the gap in the curtain was. I saw a little purple dot floating over to my right. And I'm like, holy crap, that's Wesley's helmet. He's in here with me. Oh my God, he's right there. When I first saw him out of the corner of my eye, I knew at that point I wasn't going to die. But I was so tired at that point that it took all my energy just to get to the curtain and make an attempt. So I had already used that energy. And so I retreated back to my little spot. I was like, all right, all I got to do is paddle around the corner and I can get to him. And I'm assuming he's on a rope and he's going to get pulled back. So I gathered myself and just made the attempt to paddle around the corner.
So he made an attempt, saw me, got pushed back, and then made his final attempt and was able to ferry out just far enough right next to the undercut. But I grabbed his bow and he leaned as hard as he could into it. And I just started blowing my whistle, and Isaac pulled us both all the way back.
Yeah, that was a great feeling. That was the most physically and emotionally exhausted I've ever been in my entire life.
And we got out pretty much just in the nick of time. I mean, we got out maybe a couple minutes past the time that we needed to leave. As this was happening, Shane and Jacob had set up a rope on River Right. So they had set up a rope to go down for an extraction. So we still had to climb up this mud wall, basically. It looked like rock, but it would just turn into mud. So we all had to pretty much just climb on this rope out probably 30 feet or so up to the ledge, pull our boats up. We did the paddle out, which is some class 4+. And then it was a couple mile hike out.
Very thankful for Wesley and Isaac and all of them, but especially Wesley and Isaac for going under there and risking themselves to get me. That was heroic for sure.
I was impressed by several features of this rescue, but mostly by Wesley and Isaac's tenacity. They recognized that outside help was not an option and persisted to solve the problem in front of them to make the save. The vast majority of whitewater rescues are like this. The group on scene has to make it happen right then, or it isn't happening at all. That's why this stuff is so important for us to talk about and keep learning about. There's two more main learning points I think we can take away from this story. The first is to consider this behind-the-curtain scenario on large waterfalls. I know of several incidents of it, including the fatal drowning of a good friend. Keep it in mind during the scouting process and think about an access and escape plan before it happens. The other point is to consider communication devices such as two-way radios on bigger missions, when there may be large drops, complex scouting, or other significant terrain obstacles between members of the group. I think it could have made a big difference here. Thanks to our guests, Curtis May and Wesley Schellmeyer, for sharing their story, and to Zach Brown from Water Resources Training. Zach and I had a longer conversation about swiftwater rescue training and urban and flood rescue in general, and I hope to include that in a later episode. More episodes are in the works, and if this colossal western snowpack this year is any indication, it's going to be a busy summer of whitewater rescues. Send me the stories, and I hope to see you on the river. Thank you for listening to The Safety Break, the Whitewater Rescue Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, hit the subscribe button and click follow on our Facebook page so that we know that you're out there. I'm also looking for more stories. If you know of an interesting non-fatal river accident or rescue, send me a few details by email, safetybreak@gmail.com. It doesn't have to be dramatic or life-threatening, just something that we all might be able to learn from. I'll see if we can turn it into an episode. Stay safe out there, and I hope to see you on the river.